Welcome to Talk Is Sheep, the official podcast of the Wild Sheep Society of British Columbia, brought to you by our title sponsor, Mountain Tough Fitness Lab. Come along with us as we take conversations that matter to you into the high alpine. We have partnered with Mountain Tough Fitness Lab to help get you in shape and mentally stronger. Whether you're a veteran hunter just starting out, the Mountain Tough app will take you to the next level. We personally train using the Mountain Tough programs, and we believe in it so much that we want to give you 6 weeks for free using code SHEEPBC. That's SHEEPBC. Check out Mountain Tough Fitness Lab. You won't be disappointed.
Hello, hello, Mr. Stelter. How's it going, El Capitan?
Well, it is Monday. It's, what do they call it? Easter Monday? That's a good Monday. What is it? It's supposed to be a holiday or something.
Yeah, it's some people get the day off, some people don't. We had Good Friday, so now I guess we're Easter Monday is all that would
that's
be.
That's it, Easter Monday. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's your egg hunt this weekend? Or?
No, I didn't get an egg hunt in, but yeah. So are we allowed to still say Easter? Is that allowed or what? Because there was some controversy on the internet this weekend on that, right?
So. I guess it depends on what side of the fence you're on, but I'm saying happy Easter.
Happy Easter, Greg. Yeah. So I won't say it to all our listeners. I'll say it to you, Greg. So, and those of you that maybe celebrate, happy Easter to you too. Anyway, enough on that. I don't want to get myself fired over the whole Easter thing. But what a cool podcast, eh?
Yeah. No, Gabriella Hoffman just stumbled across her work not long ago, and she's got a voice in politics and hunting and conservation and women in the outdoors. And you know, we unpack a lot in this podcast in a short amount of time. Unfortunately, she had a timeline, and we're going to have to get her back on because we got a lot more to talk about with her.
So she is in Washington, D.C. She's does a bunch of policy work. She's a PR specialist. She has her own podcast, District of Conservation. Greg talks about that on the podcast, and so does she. But I think the key takeaway here is that, you know, we asked her, you know, what are some of the big issues? What do we need to do? And it's an election year in the U.S. So if you're a U.S. listener, obviously you got an election coming up. For us British Columbians, this fall we have an election. And there's been some pretty dramatic changes on the landscape here in B.C. We've got the new Conservative Party. They're making waves. They're actually ahead in the polls, ahead of the United Party. And then federally, next year, 2025, October, I think we are, we have a federal election. So, Greg, you're Government Engagement Committee Chair. I think this is a kind of a good opportunity to sort of listen, talk to our listeners and say, hey, get involved. We need to make sure that, you know, we do all this work on the landscape. You know, we raise money and we're super passionate about wild sheep and wildlife. And but it's really important that we are sort of making sure that that's reflected in who's holding public office. And if we can put candidates in there or elected officials in there that are actually going to look after wildlife and make that a priority, I think that's really important. And this is not vote liberal or NDP or conservative. There's none of that going on. You need to make your own informed decisions, and we as a society aren't going to inform you on who you should vote for. But there's people that do a better job of looking after wildlife than others, and you need to figure out who those are and vote for them. I know I do that. I try and do that every election. I'm going to continue to do that. So,
yeah, no, I'm in the same boat. What's better for wildlife and our way of life is the way I go. I want my kids to continue to grow up the way I did and be able to hunt and fish and enjoy the outdoors. So that's the way my votes go. It's whoever's advocating for that lifestyle to continue is the way I like to continue. And then, you know, this year is going to be an active time for our Government Engagement Committee. You know, we kind of disappeared last year. We had some few hot button issues that wasn't really committee meeting worthy. It was get your shit together. We have 24 hours to get something out. So we always put the onus kind of on you, Kyle, to write something. And then we proofread and go, yeah, let's do that. Let's go there. Get the act now going. But you know, this is going to be a good year for people who want to get involved and, you know, you have opportunity to join our Government Engagement Committee and, you know, maybe be a voice in your riding and you can engage with your MLAs and we can help you out with that. And, you know, we want to have a voice in all our ridings and we're a bit short of that in BC, but we can, together we can, you know, move the needle for some things and engage our MLAs and get the ball rolling. And if you, you know, if you want, there's so many different ways to reach out to us too, but we've kind of launched this new thing recently on our website to help you get involved with the Wild Sheep Society. So if you go to our website, wildsheepsociety.com/volunteer, you can basically say what you want to do and you'll be on our list that we're going to hassle you when we need somebody.
Yeah, well said, Greg. And, you know, I can't say this enough. Gabriella talks about this on our show here that you're going to hear shortly, but get involved. Get involved with your elected officials. Go and get, you should know them on a first name basis. You should be able to call them up and say, hey, you're my MLA. Can I come in and have a meeting? Because what we ideally want, and this is self-serving as the society, we want people in there that are going to advocate for our interests. And so here's the way it works. You've got 81 elected officials across the province. There's the premier, right? And the premier rules the country, the province in this case. And the elected officials come in and they're like, there's hot button topics in their ridings. And it's like, well, if everyone's talking about, you know, wildfires, if everyone's talking about water, if everybody's talking about carbon tax, if everybody's talking about addiction, if everyone's talking about whatever, the premier listens because that's votes. That's important to them. So if every single society member is in there and they're complaining to their elected official that, hey, you need to look out for wildlife and this is important, that's going to get back to the premier. Now, if one person does it, if I do it, it's not going to really get back to the premier, right? But if we have 1,500 members that are doing that, that stuff goes back to the premier and then they make policy based on that. And so it's really important that we get involved. We get to know our MLA, and it doesn't matter if they're what stripes they are. And it's hard; it's really difficult, but you can do it. I've been persistent. I've got NDP representation. They're not keen to meet with hunters per se, you know, on the surface. And I get to go in and meet with her, and she's been great. And I have to give her kudos, and she's actually listened to my issues. So I guess this is a call to action that, and it doesn't mean. If you're listening to this and you happen to be in Washington or you happen to be somewhere else outside BC, it doesn't matter. Just get involved. Get involved with your elected officials. Get to know them. They have a responsibility to meet with their constituents. And if you're the squeaky wheel, you'll get the grease. It's a fact. And that's how I've done it. I've gone in. I've been in their office. I've knocked on their doors and they've met. So get involved. This is an election year in British Columbia. There's things that we don't like. There's things they're doing. We just talked about it through the Engage Now website that we had issues. So please do your part, get involved, take half an hour out of your life once every month. It's nothing. And if it saves something that you care passionately about or it invests in wildlife, it's a bloody good thing. It's probably the best 30 minutes you could spend.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then to go on the society side of things right now, you know, by the time this podcast comes out, we're going to just had the Spence's Bridge sheep count, but we have other sheep counts coming up. April 20th, we have the South Thompson Kamloops Lake one, and there'll be a pub night in Kamloops at Earl's with that, and there'll be some giveaways, and that'll be a good one. And then we have more counts coming up in June, July, and August. We also have the Ruck for the Shoelaps coming up, which is going to be new this year. We're going to make you sweat your bag off in the Shoelap range while you're looking for sheep, and Matt Ward and Matt McCabe, they're going to break you on that one if you sign up. But no, we got a lot going on, and you know, I love what we're doing here with the Wild Sheep Society, and we're always looking for help. So again, go to that link on our website because we need volunteers on those sheep counts. The Fraser River is not the easiest for us, and it is definitely got its issues. So we need help glassing those difficult terrains along the banks of the Fraser between Lillooet and Williams Lake is... We'll have a designated area, but that whole stretch of the Fraser is, I don't want to say a nightmare to count, but it is not easy. And it, you know, sitting in 40 degree temperatures in the desert grasslands there, we run into issues glassing and headaches and sweating and dehydration. Okay.
I'm going to take you off the marketing team. I'm just saying, okay, there's things you're good at, but marketing is not, I'm just kidding.
But you get to come hang out with some cool people. I won't be there for a lot of it this time, but usually I'm there. We got other cool guys. But again, go to that link on our website, or not link, thewildsheepsociety.com/volunteer and get your name down on the list.
Yeah, I think if you go to the homepage, go to our homepage, wildsheepsociety.com, and one of the action blocks there is sign up for a volunteer list. It's right there. So super easy to do, and that's who we're going to use our call it list. And like Greg said, we've been Spence's Bridge is good. It's popular. It's close to Vancouver. Everyone shows up. It's great. But we really need more widely distributed counts done, especially in the Fraser River. So awesome.
Well, with that, shall we roll into this podcast with Gabrielle Hoffman or Gabriella?
This episode is sponsored by our conservation partner, Precision Optics. Thank you, Sitka Gear and Precision Optics, for investing in healthy wildlife and sustainable ecosystems.
Perfect. Hello, hello, Gabriella. How's it going?
Going well. Thank you guys for having me on the program.
Oh, you're welcome. How's it going with you, Mr. Stelter?
Good. It's pretty exciting. I'm super stoked to talk to you today, Gabriella. Lots going on in the world, and it's an election year in the U.S., so I'm sure you'll have lots to talk about. And there's being out of Washington, I'm just really keen to sort of get that dyed-in-the-wool sort of, you know, right at the, I guess, at the headwaters of everything in your perspective. So I'm really stoked to chat with you today about everything.
It's very good to convene with hunters such as yourselves from Canada. You guys have a very tough landscape. I feel extremely horrible for all of our Canadian counterparts. You guys have had some crazy restrictions enacted on you. I know in your region, grizzly bear hunting has been taken away and they're looking possibly to get rid of other forms of hunting, and they've gone really aggressively after semi-automatic firearms. We haven't had that, thankfully, yet in the United States. We have a lot of pushback because of our Second Amendment. But it's always good to cross-pollinate, and I'm happy to talk about politics or whatever else you guys want me to talk about with you.
Yeah, you kind of nailed that one. We've had a tough go around lately. But for our listeners, just to get to know you and tell us about your journey into the world of outdoor advocacy and your passion for that.
I'm a dyed-in-the-wool angler. So I first started fishing when I was really young, and I'm kind of interesting as an American. My family fled the Soviet Union. I know actually Canada has a lot of immigrants to the country from the former Soviet Union. So you guys have a bigger share than I think the United States, but my family's from what is known as Lithuania today. It was one of the first countries to break away from the Soviet Union. My dad loved to fish, and he instilled that love of the outdoors and nature into me. Even growing up in California, which is not really seen as like a sportsman's paradise today, it was when I was growing up there in the early 90s. You could go fishing for the most part. You could go hunting, although to me, it didn't seem like hunting was marketed really well in California. So I never thought you could go hunting. I always thought, you know, it's off limits. Since I lived in suburban Orange County, California, by the time I was born, I think it was a year into the mountain lion ban in California. So I was born in 1991. 1990 is when they restricted mountain lion hunting. So I wasn't even thinking, you know, like what type of hunting was allowed. And fishing was just a lot easier to do and more within reach as an activity. So my father and I did that, and I got really seriously interested in it by the time I was 12. And then it was, you know, kind of a gateway activity into shooting sports and later on hunting, because I just wasn't aware of hunting opportunities. My dad was just so busy, you know, with his business. He's in construction. And when you move to a new country, as my parents did, I was born in the United States, first in my family. They were just too busy, and fishing was just much easier, fewer barriers to entry, not so many different moving parts, you know, having to get a firearm or having to do all this, and not knowing, I think, where the suitable like public land areas were. It was just probably too much for my dad to grasp. He always wanted to do hunting, and he's gone hunting back in the old country. He was part of a moose hunt, did a lot of field dressing with my uncle. So he always had an interest. And I recently taught him how to hunt recently, kind of returning the favor to him after he taught me how to fish. And I taught him how to shoot guns more properly and also do hunting. So it's dyed-in-the-wool angler, learned from my father, like I feel like most people do, a lot of women do. But in the United States and maybe in Canada now going forward, I think like it's kind of where women are now teaching their kids to go how to fish, and maybe similarly with hunting as well. So we do start to see kind of an equalization in terms of who is introducing people to these sports. But in fishing in the United States, I've seen increasingly that more and more mothers are showing their kids how to do it. But it's still perfectly fine that dads do it too, because I think that's just a natural thing, you know, father-daughter bonding time. Fishing is a great activity to do it. And that's how we started, you know, in my trajectory, in my career. And he told me family stories, and there was just so much. Obviously, whenever you go fishing, and there was always an incentive to, as a little kid, you know, we were all young, or if you guys have kids, you probably know this. I don't have kids, but I have nieces and nephews, but I remember being young and there was incentives from my dad to be like, okay, if you go fishing with me, we will go to like this restaurant, or I'll give you this snack, early on when I wasn't so fanatical about fishing. But as I got older, he didn't really need to bribe me anyway to go fishing. But it was always a great backdrop. And we also visited a lot of national parks. So I was kind of like a naturalist. You know, I always had an interest in going outdoors, and I lived really close to the beach in Orange County. So I really loved being outside. I do miss the beach now that I live in the Washington, D.C. area. It's about 2.5 hours, close to 3 hours to the closest beach in Delaware. And then it's about 4 to my coast in the Virginia coastal region. But yeah, loved the ocean, loved nature, and it kind of translated really well into my career. So I do a lot. I don't know how familiar you guys are with my background, but I've done a combination of grassroots organizing, PR, media, and more recently in the last 5 years, I've really steeped into public policy. And there's really no barrier to going into public policy. In the United States, we have this debate over, do you need a degree to extrapolate, translate public policy? And I like to think I'm proof that you don't need to. I studied political science in my university, but to grasp public policy, it really shouldn't take a PhD, an MA, a JD. It helps, but it doesn't necessarily make it relatable. So it's kind of neat to be in a position where I just have a bachelor's of arts and I'm just really good at extrapolating data and researching really well. And it's really helped me in my policy work now, where I do handle conservation quite a bit, along with energy, do podcasting, been placed in a lot of news outlets. I have a pulse in a lot of the stuff, you know, relating to apex predators in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, stuff that I don't even have any proximity to anymore, or that I'm a little removed from. But I have friends who are facing these challenges of, you know, human predator conflicts, or there's a restriction coming from Washington, D.C., not too far across the river from me, restricting like what you can use on public land. So I like to think I have a good pulse on things, and I rely heavily on people who can be good sources for me, and just you read easily available materials and just translate it to audiences. It's not rocket science. So I'm happy to be in the position I am to kind of relay this information out to people, not only in the United States, but I also think it's important for Canadians to know what's going on here. And I try my best to follow what happens further north where you guys are too. Cause like I mentioned earlier, you guys have faced a lot of hurdles, and we don't want to become like what Canada has become, or even worse, Australia has forbidden like duck hunting. That's inconceivable to me. Like something like that would be controversial in a place like Australia. So I feel like we all have to care about one another's countries, our backyards, and fight alongside each other. So that's kind of like a wraparound. So I do have some proximity, of course, quite a bit of proximity to these outdoor activities. I feel like you do as a journalist or an observer or a political policy person or a public policy person to at least have some familiarity. Also, it breeds trust whenever you're dealing with stakeholders or people. And I've been able to make friendships and relationships and good ties with people in politics and all across the United States because they've trusted me to steward their information or steward their story really well. And it kind of in an unfiltered, unbiased way, where other people in media or public policy would just dismiss them and say, well, you're killing all these animals. You have no regard for nature. You're a terrible environmentalist. But we kind of check them and say, well, actually, we have a longstanding tradition in the United States. We have some laws called Pittman-Robertson, Dingell-Johnson, which relate to hunting and fishing conservation monies respectively. And so when I can point back to that, people kind of like, you know, are taken aback by that, or they want to do more research. So we do have the facts on our side. I don't know what equivalent you guys have in terms of funding mechanisms in Canada, but in the United States, we're really lucky where we do have laws that protect hunting and fishing, whether across the states through right to hunt fish amendments or through different funding mechanisms that say, and also funding bills like Pittman-Robertson, Dingell-Johnson, which say that you can hunt and fish, and hunting and fishing is going to primarily fund conservation funding across habitat restoration, wildlife conservation efforts, hunters education, and more recently, public target shooting ranges. So that's kind of a nutshell of who I am and what I have kind of my reading into these days, especially.
Greg, you're muted, buddy.
That's a fail. At least you told me, and just keep going. So when you talk about the your day job and the conservation side of things, is that kind of what inspired you to start the District of Conservation podcast? Because like, you know, you're running 6 years, 425 episodes, and you hit heavy hitting topics on the daily there, basically.
Yeah, weekly. Sometimes two episodes a week, depending upon my mood. As we're recording, I just put out two episodes. But yes, it's been a lot. And I had multiple episodes in certain years, maybe around COVID time. I think I just got cranking to podcasting because there was nothing else to do even more. So definitely, yes, it's more than probably the typical podcast of the age that DOC has, but it's kind of a riff of District of Columbia, from which all policies, like I said, this funding mechanism, Pittman Robertson, Dingell Johnson, emanates from. So I kind of wanted to be punny but clever as a way to be like, you know, foisting this interconnectedness that we have between what happens federally all across all 50 states and vice versa. And so people liked it. They liked the name. My sister, who's really big into marketing, was like, oh, this is clever. Very good roll off the tongue. And I started it in response to what I think was kind of different, partly misinformation, but also it was, you know, very early onset, I would say, of wilderness podcasts. So it wasn't such a saturated market or saturated podcast medium or in this space. And now there's, I don't even know how many podcasts, and it's hard to compete because there's always something new or always something very enticing. But I started it as a response to kind of some of the attacks that were being leveled against the Trump administration. And I had befriended a lot of people and developed a lot of relationships through press work into the administration. So I got to know the two different interior secretaries. So interior secretary manages all public lands, wildlife lands, under the umbrella of Bureau of Land Management, Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, and all these other entities, kind of tentacles I won't go into and bore your listeners with, but there's an infrastructure, and I got to know the people behind the infrastructure because I was always very curious, like, okay, so what does my Fish and Wildlife Service do, or what are these interior secretaries, what's their purpose? And so I made it a mission to not so much like be, you know, kissing up to them or anything of that sort. I just wanted to understand them and their policy and be like, well, I have some commonality with them. And I was just seeing so much anti-hunting rhetoric, anti-fishing rhetoric come out there. And there wasn't really a political show at the time. Meat Eater touches upon politics. We have some of their folks have slightly different politics than me. So I may come about, you know, my understanding of public lands, multiple uses a little differently than some of Stephen Ronello's co-hosts. But I think there is some commonality, but it's a little different too. You didn't really see at the time a lot of female hosts, and I don't really harp on, you know, the gender stuff, but it was kind of neat to be one of the few females early on to kind of tackle the politics of conservation and then also couple it with storytelling. So it was unique in that respect too, but there wasn't really anything addressing the politics of conservation at the time. So I thought I could help fill the void and talk to people I know, people who are influencing policy across the federal government, also across the states. So it's kind of been, materialized into something really interesting. And I don't know how long I'm going to keep it going, but for the foreseeable future, it's still going to be, you know, cranking out different podcasts and episodes. And I have touched upon Canada too. I think actually one of the earliest things I talked about was Justin Trudeau banning some sort of firearm or something. So I do touch on Canada a little lightly and somewhat internationally too, but mostly it's chiefly focused on domestic American kind of like conservation politics or debates or battles. It could be something as innocuous as, you know, someone is trying to prohibit something in one state, or some crazy animal rights advocate group is, you know, organizing some sort of campaign that is really worth kind of dissecting and exposing. So it could vary really on the mood or what's trending in the news cycle, or maybe bringing a story that hasn't been touched upon to greater light. I talk a lot about national monuments here in the United States. I don't know if you guys have an equivalent in Canada. So forgive me if I'm pleading ignorance here with it, but it's a degree of public land where it should be open to multiple uses. You protect artifacts of historical, cultural, significant scientific significance, but you can't use it as a justification to shut down, let's say, recreational uses or even some commercial uses, but they do with who we have currently in office right now. So in some cases, I've heard monument designations may actually restrict sheep hunting in New Mexico or something like that, or even oryx hunting. And I feel like it would affect, you know, sheep hunters too, to some extent. They don't want them at some point to go, you know, backcountry hunting too, if they can feel it, if they can help it. They'll go after the sheep hunters eventually if they haven't already. And so just looking for those kind of like idiosyncrasies really interests me. And it's not sexy. It's not really, you know, fun to talk about, but it's something worth sharing and informing my listeners of, because those have countrywide implications, not just out west, but here in the DC area, out east. So it's kind of fun what the podcast has shaped into. And it's always changing. It's always, you know, picking on a topic that may be interesting or something more closer to home. I pay attention to what happens in Virginia very closely, my adopted state. So it's a fun project. So I appreciate you asking.
Yeah, well, it's like I said, it's 425 episodes, so it's got some longevity to it. We're not even halfway there. But how do you, through the podcast and then through your work, how do you address the misconceptions about hunting and conservation, particularly regarding the impact of hunting on the environment?
I think it's actually pretty easy to address the misconceptions, whether it would be me inserting my firsthand account, having done some amount of hunting now in the 7 years I've done it. So I can insert, personal anecdotes or my own firsthand experience going hunting. What are the safety rules? Are people reckless? Are you engaging in wanton waste? And all the places I've hunted, I have not seen that. And I don't condone any of those activities, where you're poaching or engaging in wanton waste or doing something where you could, jeopardize the hunt. I've had a lot of hunting trips where I didn't harvest anything. It was largely a learning experience. I feel like half of my hunting trips have been that way and half have been very successful. But if I'm very limited in my knowledge, like I've never been bear hunting, I've never been elk hunting, I've never been sheep hunting. So I bring in people who have proximity to those forms of hunting more than me. And I pick their brain. I ask them, like, what does this type of hunting entail? You have to educate me, educate my listeners, because you have direct experience, direct firsthand knowledge of this. So I have very good connections with a group called the American Bear Foundation. I love talking about bears because bears are super fascinating to me. They're also very delicious. That's the Eastern European in me. And so I love seeing the bear cubs. I think the conservation process that goes into bear management is so fascinating, even here in the United States. And I know you guys had dealt with, of course, with the grizzly bear ban, and there's probably been debate over whether or not you want to ban, or whether or not Canada wants to ban, black bear hunting. They even consider black bear hunting in the United States trophy hunting, even though the numbers prove that black bears are not endangered whatsoever. So I love bringing on like the bear guys that I talk to, bear conservationists, because it's just such a fascinating world that they live in. And there's so many like components to bear hunting. And it's not just about the harvest, but it's also supporting, through bear hunting and hunting in general, you are supporting monies to help bear den studies. And people in the United States go nuts over the bear den studies and the bear cubs. At some point, I'm supposed to be shadowing the biologists and doing that at some point. I was promised this year again, but I wasn't able to make that happen, or that opportunity didn't materialize. But there's a lot of disconnect between those cuddly bear den studies and bear huggers that the Fish and Wildlife departments will enlist versus where that derives from hunting. So when people put the two and two together, they're startled. They're alarmed. They're really surprised that that's how the connection is made, through the Partner with a Pair program, what we have here in the United States through the Fish and Wildlife Service. And so when you're able to put together those two kind of contrasting things, the killing of a bear for management purposes, and seeing those monies go towards subsisting and continuing that population, then it's really fascinating. And a lot of animal rights activists don't know how to refute that. They're like, oh, well, okay, I kind of understand this, but this is still such a vile practice. You're killing bear cubs. It's like, nobody condones the killing of bear. You don't do that. If you do that, you should be penalized to the fullest extent. Lose your hunting privileges if you're engaging in those type of very shoddy practices. Absolutely abhorrent to do that. And so, stuff like that, where you're able to insert like the cuddly, cute, bear pictures. Or another thing that I really like, I haven't, like I said, gone elk hunting yet, but I've seen elk restoration firsthand here in Virginia. And going to see the elk firsthand, talking to the stakeholders there. They're former energy workers who worked in coal and energy industries in Virginia, much like, or the United States, much like in Canada, have been very lambasted. So I like to talk to stakeholders who are often vilified and kind of cast aside as like bad, proponents of the environment. They're not, because their livelihood depends on having a clean environment, making sure that their industry is not polluting the waterways, that the elk and white-tailed deer can cohabit with those who live on the landscape. And so even, finding those type of angles, which exist, they're not, mutually exclusive. Same with farmers and conservation. A lot of the times American farmers, I bet you, much like Canadian farmers, are often given a bad rap. They're told they're despoilers of the environment. Their cows are ruining the landscape. They're farting, burping, doing whatever to despoil it. But I've talked to a lot of ranchers in Montana, Florida, elsewhere, and without the cows on the landscape, there's no regenerative practices occurring. And the running kind of tagline in Florida is Florida cows cows keep Florida green, or insert whatever state keeps, such and such. Cows keep this state green. Debunking that type of stuff, or like the misnomers or the misconceptions about what type of conservation stakeholders there are. And a lot of these people who work in energy and agriculture, often who are vilified for being, you know, despoilers of the environment, a lot of them are hunters too, and they fish as well. So I think giving them a shot and a platform to speak to kind of challenge those preconceived notions is extremely important. And you would be remiss to not include them, because they're very integral in stakeholder relations. And given that they have dual purposes, dual interests, you know, I don't think it's smart to say that everything is just so one-sided. And what you think of a typical environmentalist is not a conservationist. They're really a rewilder, or even like a preservationist, a radical preservationist. So they've kind of taken the term in America hostage to say that anything that they deem, you know, to be conservation is actually really not conservation. When you look into the grand scheme of things, it's not wise use. It's no use, and no use is not conservation. You have to tend to the land. You have to have people, you know, be able to access it. And I think here in North America, in totality, we do see some people misconstruing what conservation is. And that's why, you know, whether it's where you guys are in Canada or my vantage point here in the United States, we have to make sure that conservation is upheld. And that's what the podcast often does. And I hope, and I have no doubt your podcast also sheds light on that too, but conservation has been hijacked as a term across North America by these very well-funded animal rights activists, and it's needing to be taken back. And that's what my podcast tries to do. I try to do it through my other endeavors as well. I talk to a lot of stakeholders who are very active in making sure the correct portrayal of conservation is communicated. It's extremely important. And then when people see that these actors who may be well-funded and very loud, but they actually don't really put their money where their mouth is, or they don't really go outdoors in a lot of the cases. They speak from a kind of ivory tower to lecture to us about like what we should consume, how we should hunt, how we should fish, but they've never once experienced it. So they're lecturing to us what to do, remove from the situation, and then they want to change how things work in wildlife conservation politics. So it's it's difficult sometimes to wrestle with it, but I love bringing on people who can debunk preconceived notions or stereotypes and really showcase what true conservation is.
So Gabriella, so you talk about that and about conservation and then if we extend that a little further with hunting and angling, consumptive use. So we take that and we've been vilified, right? The conservation word's been vilified. There's obviously this movement from, you know, one political spectrum that sort of has this narrative. You know, what's our strongest key to combating that? Is it public advocacy, sort of, you know, getting the right message out there? Is it in Ottawa? Is it in Washington, in D.C.? Is that where we're going to fix it? Is it a multi-stakeholder approach or multi-faceted approach? What's our best way? And obviously, you're doing it through the podcast. We try and do it through ours. We have a campaign called One Campfire that specifically is to sort of debunk some of these myths and bring hunters and non-hunters together, mm-hmm. sort of the 80%, the middle ground, like we're not trying to advocate for two hunters or to the non-hunter or to the anti-hunter. It's to the non-hunter that's sort of ambivalent, right? So, but what's in your opinion, based on your work on policy and everything you've done in Washington, what's our best approach moving forward? Where should we be investing our resources on that?
I think there are several ways that you guys could kind of prioritize your resources and focus on certain initiatives or efforts. I would say first and foremost, partaking in effective storytelling. I know you guys have you guys have great filmmakers, storytellers in Canada. I can think off the top of my head several people from Canada, you know, the typical people who are usually thrown out there, the Shockies and whatnot. But even beyond the Shockies, I know there are lots of great hunters. Rachel Attila, I haven't met her yet, but we're social media connected and she looks really awesome. I would love to speak with her and I think we're going to do an interview at some point. But I feel like storytellers, or even just you guys yourselves, you know, the regular hunter, angler, can share their story. We have started to see certain groups here. We have a group called Howl for Wildlife in the United States. I'm kind of a relatively new nonprofit. So they had a campaign about like, I'm a trophy hunter, to demystify what a trophy hunter is, because trophy is very subjective. It could be something as simple as, you know, harvesting waterfowl to pursuing big game. And so they wanted to take back the trophy moniker. So sharing your own story, I would say first and foremost, to whatever venues you can in Canada, Ottawa especially, is extremely important as it relates to policy and legislative aims. You guys have a slightly different governmental system than us. We have a representative republic. You guys are more of a parliamentary system. So it's really hard to kind of translate that, because you're not you guys aren't electing, we elect a president, you guys elect parties, to which then the party who wins a majority then elects the leader. A little different. But I think my understanding is, and I follow a little bit of the opposition leaders who want to challenge your current prime minister. I would say to challenge to your listeners and other Canadians listening, from just my own personal opinion, not so much my employer, but for me, the individual conservationist, what I want to impart to you guys and your listeners is meeting with and elevating the members of parliament who are campaigning actively for conservation or for hunting. There have to be some representatives. I have no doubt you have members of parliament in Ottawa who represent all the different provinces who support hunting. I know a lot of them have campaigned against the semi-automatic weapons ban or firearms ban. So maybe looking to those people and entrusting your story with them or trying to build rapport with them, I think is a good way to convey the hunting, you know, perspective or the conservationist perspective. We have a lot of people here, and you may have noticed a theme through my podcast or some of my work, is I like to interview lawmakers who go hunting and fishing. And so I've been able to find commonality with chairmen of different congressional committees, governors, local officials, people who formerly served or cabinet secretaries, all of the above, people who influence policy directly, indirectly. And so I feel like you guys have the equivalent in Canada. You have to have some sort of minister who handles this, or even if they're not in agreement, at least like to meet with them, ask them, you know, could you please meet with us? We want to understand why you're pursuing this. This would be better for you to do and implement. If you have members of parliament who are very amenable to the conservationist way of life, whether it starts or stems from fighting the semi-automatic rifle ban, I bet you can find some commonality. And then I don't know how, in terms of your press, you guys have less freedom of speech than we do, unfortunately. So I don't know how writing like letters to the editor or op-eds are, but what we've seen people here do, especially in states that are more hostile to the hunting way of life, we see a lot of people doing write-in campaigns to put letters to the editor, and perhaps in your individual provinces or in some of the bigger national papers, maybe writing an op-ed in defense of hunting, going off of your story or going off of some sort of prohibition, and using data. I bet you guys can find a lot of data about increased human-bear conflicts in BC with the grizzly bear hunt being done away with, and also just what those activists have done. They've done rewilding, and rewilding is not conservation. They've totally upended the landscape of conservation in your region, from what I understand. And so putting out the facts and realities of what the consequences of losing hunting, even, you know, something as controversial or you know, something as widely, you know, discussed like grizzly bear hunting, it often leads to prohibitions further down the chain. So making that connection too. So I would say storytelling, telling your own story, trying to curry, you know, relationships with those elected members of parliament, maybe those who want to replace your current prime minister, and tell them, you know, you will gain a lot of people to your cause if you support true conservation efforts. Maybe you're missing potential supporters by not touching upon this issue. So maybe telling them to say that, you know, this could be a campaign issue for you running for the party or for whatever position within your province or within your district. I would say it's probably province, not district. We have districts here. So it would just be that. And then trying to convey it to a wider medium or soliciting interviews or talking to reporters who may be interested. But I feel like you guys have even a hostile or more hostile media landscape and probably journalists who are less open-minded, less understanding of conservation. They probably just toe a certain line. But if you do find some friendlies or people who are objective, it's worthwhile to talk to them. So those are kind of three recommendations, excuse me, that I have, that Canadians can do with whatever infrastructure you have. Cause like I said, it's a little bit different from the United States. We do face some hurdles here, but I think Canada could equally replicate. And I would say a fourth actually recommendation, you guys may work with Safari Club International, and Wild Sheep Foundation here in the United States. So working with the parent organizations of chapters that exist in your country is also very helpful because they can help with lawsuits in their capacity. I think they have people who are lobbyists in Canada or Europe or wherever. And so we have American-based organizations which are really involved in international fights. And so I would say deploying those who have a lot of resources like SEI can also be extremely helpful to doing a combination of those three recommendations I have.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting you mentioned, you know, companies like Howell and whatnot, because you know, Howell stepped up to bat for us a few times now with different things going on here with the government.
Excellent. I think I have seen that.
And then you mentioned our media. Just quick little story that sidetracks is I tried to get a bunch of your articles in lead up to this podcast and I couldn't open them.
You couldn't open them?
All the websites were blocked.
Well, because Meta's blocked, nope. Right?
We're blocked, so I couldn't even read some of your stuff. And I'm like, oh, this is, it's making it interesting. A lot of your published work, we can't
even natively
access.
Going to a URL, or did you do it through social media? Because I know Meta banned it. Links.
Yeah, so through social medias, and then some of the URL stuff I can get through too. But
well, if
yeah,
you need me to help break that, I'll send you blank. Links directly. That's so nuts. What was the justification for banning so-called political articles?
I think it's just they misinformation or whatever they want
even
stronghold on it.
That's so silly. I did read that and I was like scratching my head when I saw that. So that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Oh well. Makes it more fun. you kind of touched on the broad scale of how to engage and whatnot there. Kind of the same advice for, you know, Joe Blow trying to get their message across to hunters or navigate these interesting waters that we're in these interesting times, and suggest, you know, just going and talking to, I guess, I'm not sure what the equivalent there would be, but it'd be our MLAs. So they're kind of the people of the separate regions, so to speak, mm-hmm, for government.
MLAs. What does that stand for, MLAs?
Members of Legislative Assembly.
Oh, so like Congress, maybe. Maybe that's the equivalent.
Yeah, it's they're similar to Congress type.
They're actually the state elected officials, so it'd be somebody that,
like state legislatures.
Is at the state level.
Okay.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is a little different than us. I didn't think, maybe within the, because like you have governors of each province, right? Or premier? No, not premiers.
Yeah,
governors.
Yeah, we have
exactly.
Premiers of
premiers.
Each.
Premiers. Yeah. Okay, so they're your governors.
And then the provinces are divided into a bunch of little areas, or some big areas, I guess.
Yeah. So you can even the regular Canadian hunter angler could lobby at that, you know, province level too. I don't know how entrenched it is, like it is here in the United States, but we have seen people have impacts very successfully to stop slow erosion of hunting. So I don't know if you have the equivalent. I think you guys do have the equivalent of wildlife commissions, but in certain states here, as you probably have seen, we have seen governors who would be your premiers essentially appointing people who are anti-hunting, anti-fishing. More recently, it's the state of Vermont that's starting to engage in this, but it's largely concentrated to Washington State, Oregon, California, Colorado, kind of these very anti-hunting enclaves. But we have seen a lot of pushback with outfits like Howl. They're really good about creating forms. Sportsman's Alliance is also pretty good. SEI is also very informed on this. But we do have now ways for people to respond and even oppose commissioner appointees or commission votes. So you prevent this hijacking of true conservation efforts at the state level or at the province level for you guys up north. And so, yes, you can even have more of an impact. And maybe I would say perhaps depending upon how Canada, weighs these kind of things, like you could have an impact in your province. And I'm hoping, I don't know if there's going to be, if you guys are going to be revisiting, you know, reintroducing a grizzly hunt. I hope so, because it makes no sense to not have that anymore. But maybe if push came to shove or more increased bear human conflicts came, you guys could petition your province to say like, well, we need to reopen the bear hunt because of this many deaths or this many conflicts or this loss of monies that are going back to conservation. So I think Canadians can certainly look to, you know, to fight more locally if Ottawa is just very stubborn or unwilling to change anything or lift, let's say, certain restrictions. And what is happening with the Second Amendment stuff or the semi-automatic stuff? Was that ever proceeded? Did that ever proceed, or is that kind of in a standstill?
Well, you got your mic off, Kyle.
It's not good. So Bill C-21 is the main thing that we've been dealing with, but you know, it's multifaceted. I'm not sure if you're aware, but they've actually banned now the sale of handguns in Canada. So
what?
You can no longer acquire a handgun yet. They haven't banned them outright, but they banned the sale of them. So you can no longer buy a handgun in Canada. You can't even secondhand sell a handgun.
What?
So basically it's going to die with the owner. So they've killed the handguns in Canada completely. So, and it's I don't know a ton about it. I'm not a policy guy when it comes to the firearm stuff, but they've made it so difficult that if we have a change of government, it's not a simple reversal where they just reenact it. It has to go through a very significant process. So And then on top of it, C21, it was banning like very niche firearms, like semi-autos, and but there was a whole bunch of stuff in there, like even a simple Weatherby Mark V could be banned under that. It was a bolt action because it had certain kilojoules. It was just like, it's just ridiculous. So it's a nightmare, and really, you know, there's no change. So it's been a train wreck for us here in Canada on the gun side of things, for sure.
Yeah, which
and again, it's on the legal, law-abiding firearm owner side. It's, you know, we still have gang crime and everything is just rampant, right? It hasn't. It's made the Well, I'm not saying it's made it worse, but the numbers are certainly worse than it was prior to the to the change, right? So anyway,
yeah,
horrible.
Yeah, prohibitions don't lead to reduction of crime, and it just really infringes on rights. That's why we here in the States are very keen on not allowing any bans to go through. And actually, public opinion has changed actually in favor of the Second Amendment here. And also because those monies largely go back to conservation funding through those PR Dingell Johnson dollars I alluded to earlier. But that's crazy. You can't just, with a change in leadership, you can't remove it. Because here in the United States, we, even if you enact a rule, I actually think you can reverse a lot quicker an executive order or a regulatory kind of means than you can a bill in Congress. You know, a legislation takes a lot more effort to repeal, but our regulations are actually really easy to repeal if you have the mechanism or if you use an executive order to undo that sort of action. But some things, it kind of goes back and forth too, because we have the court system too, and the courts are like a check on the government. And when they tell them you can't restrict this type of gun or you can't restrict this type of hunting, they still proceed. Our federal government still proceeds in doing that. Our states still do that. So we sometimes face hurdles there, but I know it's, you guys have a tall, you know, hurdle with your stuff. That's crazy. It can't just be undone. Not that it would be undone with like a snap of fingers, but that's crazy. It takes a whole ordeal to get rid of that. So like, even if you got a reformer in place, it would have to, so many hoops would have to be jumped through to be able to change it. If that was the case in the United States, like we wouldn't pass anything. I wish we could like import some of our stuff over to you guys. I feel bad when other countries don't have that, especially our neighbors to the north. But it makes me feel very lucky that we're Americans down here and we have kind of this unique system. But our politicians abuse it too, and they don't care even if they're told that you can't change a certain law or you have limitations here. They still proceed with it, even if the science says you can't ban this type of hunting. They're really keen on restricting grizzly bear management in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. They want to reintroduce them into Washington State, into Oregon, California, even though the science says like we don't think this is wise. And just in Idaho, I don't know if you guys saw, the judge there said that we have to stop bear hunting because they're getting stuck in wolf traps, and there's no such evidence of that. And I don't, like I said, I don't do any either of those two type of hunting forms, but my friends who are on the ground have said this is an impossibility. There's no way the bear is so stupid and slovenly getting trapped into wolf traps. So they were just finding a weird illusory correlation to justify banning these hunts. So it happens here too. We're not immune from that, and we have some very silly judicial representatives and also people in the legislative branch and also in the federal government or in rulemaking too. So we have our share of stupidity, unfortunately, as well, even with all the laws and the protections for hunting too, and guns as well.
So I'm curious, Gabriella, what do you think is sort of our biggest threat right now? So when you look at policies or things on the horizon, and there's all the anti-hunting sentiment, you know, anti-gun sentiment. There's, you know, I've seen you've had Colorado on to talk about the issues going on there. But when you look on the landscape and the political landscape from a policy perspective, and even from your podcast, just personally, what's your big, do you feel is the biggest threat right now to sort of our, I guess, way of life? And let's lump hunters, anglers, and conservationists all kind of into the same group.
Yeah, trappers too. They don't get enough love. And actually, there's a resurgence of trapping in the United States with all these coyotes preying on turkey poults and other, you know, upland. And I think even, I don't know about waterfowl, but definitely upland birds are starting to see their numbers plummet, largely because of predators that are going unchecked. But to your question, the biggest threats, there are several. I mean, here in the United States, we have a problem with regulatory overreach. We're seeing lead tackle, lead bullets being banned as a condition for opening future public lands to new hunting and fishing opportunities. I view that to be a threat. We've also seen in the United States where we have an interior secretary who oversees all of our public lands, wildlife, waterways, etc., where she is not respecting this idea of no net loss. So she's actually shrinking and closing off access in Alaska, even if you don't like caribou hunt. So if you're not a resident or you're not living in this particular region, you will lose access. By now, I think it's been codified into rulemaking. So 60 million acres have been closed off to caribou hunting for those who don't live in these districts in Alaska. So that's one of the biggest land closures I've ever heard of. And nobody's really talking about it except for a few people. One guy in Alaska that I know of, he's a great writer, reporter, and he's talked about this because this affects him and anyone else who goes hunting in Alaska. And he's like, this is the biggest closure of public lands ever. Unseen like anything else in the United States history, but it's gone under the radar because it doesn't really relate to, you know, most people, but it would affect most people who want to hunt there. I would also say, similar to what is happening in Colorado, when you have states creating like statutory language about what a trophy is, that can be exported to different states, as my guest Dan Gates from the Coloradans for Responsible Wildlife Management had mentioned. He is worried that their efforts to put, you know, this prohibition of mountain lion, big cat hunting through this trophy language, he says other states can adopt it. And even the federal government, if they choose to, could look to this trophy language and say, we're going to be implementing this countrywide. So that also equally concerns me. And going back to a point I made earlier about it takes a while for you to feel legislation, the impacts of good, bad legislation federally in the United States. Kind of similar in the states. I think it takes about a couple months. You know, something could be passed in a legislative session. Things are usually passed between January through March, and then by July 1st, you will see a new law go into effect. So you're going to see at your state level, things go into effect more immediately. So within a couple months timeframe. And like I said earlier, I think one of the concerning things is who you elect to your governorship or your premiership in Canada for that equivalent kind of comparison. Those people are stewarded with appointing commissioners, board appointees, and others who may impact conservation decisions. In my state, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, we're really lucky to have a pro-hunting, pro-fishing board. I like the administration. I think they're very favorable to it, even more so than previous administrations have been. They're also in support of the Second Amendment as well. And they have, you know, we have some holdover people from previous administrations who work in board appointees. But currently, as it's understood, you know, in many states, you have pro-hunting, pro-fishing people who are tied to the issue. Maybe they go hunting or fishing, or maybe they're involved in some sort of nonprofit organization. It could be a Wild Sheep Foundation. It could be a Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. They have some relation to the sport and they're not hostile to it at minimum. But what we're seeing in other states is, you know, these governors are appointing these rogue commissioners, these rogue representatives, and they're recommending, you know, shortening of seasons, prohibitions of certain types of hunting, bag limits that would make it impossible for you to, you know, do some sort of hunting. Or you see kind of a combination of, you know, certain states voting in ballot box biology, as was the case in Colorado. Colorado's managers were not very friendly to this idea of ballot box biology for wolf reintroduction. They were waiting to introduce wolves in a more practical format versus people in the city centers of Colorado voting narrowly to force the commission in Colorado to reintroduce them by way of this ballot box effort. And so you could see, you know, dangers with that when states that have referendums or provinces, I don't know if you guys have a referendum system, but some of our states, especially out west, have referendums. So you can add anything to your heart's desire. And they've done a lot with prohibiting certain forms of hunting, whether it's California or Colorado. So those are equally concerning when you relay the decisions away from or divert the decisions away from the wildlife managers. That should be exclusively with them. It shouldn't be left to the voters for that kind of deal, because it is a science. You have to follow the science. And when you have people who are ill-informed or who are viscerally anti-hunting deciding this, it could totally upend the North American model of wildlife conservation we have throughout the continent. And so, yeah, you just have to look to see, you know, what's happening federally in your backyard. There's a lot of different threats. So I'm trying to pay attention to all of them and educate my podcast listeners about that. But there's always something lurking in the background that is problematic. And even if it's not in my state or my locality, I'm very concerned, you know, what happens in one state could happen in mine potentially down the road.
Well, I guess we're getting close to your timeline here, but you know, that was a jam-packed conversation. I think we need to do this again sometime.
Sure, more than happy to.
because there's other topics we wanted to touch on and we didn't even get close to them. But no, that's great. And your view, as you know, your position in work life, and then, you know, you are an outdoors woman as well. Like your view and your stance on everything, it's refreshing to see. And you know, you actually know what you're talking about, which a lot of the times we don't get that. No.
I'm just an unusual person. I don't know. I try to be well-read and understand what I'm talking about, or bring in people who are experts and know more than I do. That's extremely important. But I appreciate you saying that, because it really is something. And it, like I said, it's not a hard science to crack, like to learn all this. Like if I did it, anyone can do it. I just am very persistent. And so I developed the aptitude to do it and to understand. And there are still things I don't understand. Like there are some convoluted things when it comes to legal stuff. I'm not a lawyer, so I have to defer to like my law friends or friends who work in law and ask them like, what does this mean? I'm so confused. Like, please translate this to me in civilian talk, not legalese. So I'm always okay with asking for help too. And it's okay to ask for help when you're trying to, you know, understand these issues. But I don't want to be the only person in North America doing this. And I hope someone listening, it could be, you know, young woman, young man, you know, interested in trying to change the trajectory of conservation politics in Canada or the United States or wherever, to be well-versed on the issues or to be informed is not an easy, it's not a difficult, I would say, task to do. You just begin a Google search, and from there, your opportunities are endless. And there's so much information out there. Just look at the existing laws. And look to see what others have done before you in terms of writing or literature or, you know, advance good pieces of legislation, advance, unfortunately, bad pieces of legislation, or create rules which just have so many burdens and make it harder for you to live the life you want to live, especially an outdoor lifestyle. And we see, you know, the science is in favor of this, not only because of, you know, bag limits or management, but spending time outdoors is so good for you. And we have a debate here in the United States, probably you guys do in Canada too, about social media usage and younger people, you know, the type of distractions and the mental health issues. And a solution I always tell, you know, colleagues who work in the education space or digital or tech space, I tell them, you know, recommend going outdoors, because you're going to get the kids to not want to be hooked up to their electronics all the time. And I grew up, you know, I'm in my mid-30s now, and I grew up in a time where you could, you know, be offline. We started to have social media creep when I was towards the tail end of high school, early into college. So I knew what it was like growing up with a landline telephone and all these, you know, kind of retro appliances and tech items. A lot of people, like my cousin, probably does not remember. I have a cousin who was born almost 10 years later than me, does not remember a landline, doesn't remember certain things. Or I have friends who have kids who are teenagers. They never had like a time where they grew up without technology. They always were hooked onto something, you know, a tablet, now a cell phone, a smartphone. Spending time outdoors is really good for mental health. And I wish people would stress that more too. And the proof is in the pudding in terms of how much money we put out there in the United States and also in Canada. So it's a good thing to advocate for. And I think a lot of people want to go to this like local war, know where their meat comes from. Like people are starting to rediscover eating trout, eating elk, eating deer, eating all these kinds of delicious species that are very good for you in terms of nutrient content. We also see it kind of being a counterbalance to like all these fake meat kind of inventions that are starting to come out, or these so-called plant-based products. People want naturalistic products and to know where their food comes from. So there is so much you can advocate for and promote with hunting and fishing as a lifestyle. And I think people will be open to it, especially that 80%. That's that really kind of grabbable 80%, convincible 80% that we try to reach here in the United States too.
Well, that's awesome, Gabriella. Thank you so much for your time today, and look forward to doing this again. I appreciate all you're doing for the things that we love in Washington and beyond. Appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity. It's good to connect with you guys. I really appreciate it. And let's revisit again soon.
Yeah. One last thing. If people want to follow along with you, where do they look?
Too many places to list, but I'm on all the social media outlets. You can follow my podcast, District of Conservation. I have a website, GabriellaHoffman.com. I also just launched a new vertical called The Sportswomen Show, where we interview women in the outdoors. So I think we can broaden our base and include women from Canada too. Like I said, I think I told Rachel Attila that I want to speak with her at some point, and I'll try to reach out to other Canadian women I know and am connected to as well to feature them, because I think it's unique to get their perspectives as well. But just launched that not too long ago, and it's been taking off a little bit. So it's very exciting to have that too. I have my hands in many different pots But yeah, just connect with me on social media, listen to my podcast and follow me on social media and we can connect from there. Or anyone, you know, wants to ping me with a question, I'm pretty approachable. I'll answer questions as best as I can.
Perfect. Thank you.
We wanted to deep dive into the women issues and sort of, there's lots of gender issues that you've talked about too on your show. And yes. I wanted to jump into that. I know that's a hot button item right now, but, talk lots about the women in the outdoors and hunting community. We've got a Women Shaping Conservation Program in British Columbia. Excellent. Here that, we have going. So we wanted to touch on that today. Obviously didn't have enough time, but we'll get you back on and we'll talk about women issues and women in the outdoors, sooner rather than later.
Absolutely. Thank you.